stickers and stuff.
What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? Lie in the morning. Ha! Roll along, go to the landing. The drinking life is too demanding. Tough love will leave you staggering and lonely in the morning. Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Being laid and being fired. First one drunk and the last one hired. Or lie in the morning. The kids all love you and adore you, but by evening they are looking for you, rowing the lifeboat along beside you every single morning. Loving this much has got me grieving. Can't stand by and watch you leaving. No more lies, no more deceiving. The truth comes in the morning. I'm loving the one this storm is taking. I'm on the shore and my heart is breaking. I'm watching it drowning in the making. It's gonna take me down too. So way hey and up he rises, way hey and up she rises, way hey and up they're rising drunk again in the morning. Living in guilt and dying in shame, the drunken sailor is not to blame. When he asked for help, well, millions came, and it was a brand new morning. So what do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do? That question. That age-old question. What are you going to do with the likes of someone like me? That question has been asked day after day, week after week, month after month, generation after generation for millennium. We talked about that last week. It's been asked by our family members, our parents, our siblings, extended members of our family. It's been asked by members of our church congregations. It's been asked by the legal profession and the medical community. Asked by certainly, you know, the judicial system, and just concerned members of society as a whole, all who have in their concern and desire to be helpful to someone who's suffering, have thrown their best efforts and given their time and heart and love and energy, and all have found it wanting and coming up for naught. That question really had no answer. And we talked about that last week. That simple, those simple multiple verses of that centuries-old Anglo-Saxon sea shanty pretty much sum up what we looked at last week. All the variety and various attitudes, techniques, reform movements that were thrown at us, or sometimes arose from within us, to try and solve this problem of known as alcoholism. My name is Rob S., and I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body surely by the grace of a loving God and by the power that I found as the result of the program in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous, by the awakened members of this sacred fellowship who led me to and through this program and continue to guide me today, as well as other fellowships, by the service that God leads me to and that I'm allowed and encouraged to participate in, and by a host of teachers in my life, I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That state that I currently experience today at this moment is free, recovered, able to consistently see the truth. And we talked about that from my own personal experience last week. And we'll deal with more of that today as well. Again, I will offer some brief qualifications. I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. No one really does. I do not claim to be an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous, on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, on the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Quite the opposite. I am rather daunted in spirit when someone asks me to speak on anything regarding the history of a fellowship that is so laced with myth, legend, incorrect facts, and just downright misleading stories. Not that a drunk would ever tell a falsehood or tell a tall tale. But we looked last week at the rise of the movement to try and help the inebriate in colonial America, and through the 19th century, the rise of the Washingtonians, who was one of the first mutual aid societies that grew rapidly and quickly, and within 3 years had about 600,000 members around the country, and yet died off just as quickly for any number of reasons they had. And we spoke last week specifically about our relationship of current 12-step fellowships and the lessons learned from the failings of the Washingtonians. They did not have a singleness of purpose. They allowed any and all who were interested in the subject of alcoholism into the midst. They developed exalted leaders and showcased them. They had fees and dues. They aligned themselves with outside issues in terms of political issues, and in some cases religious issues. And most importantly, there was no unified practical program for a maintenance or an ongoing sober way of living. They were very good at sobering up the drunk, not so good at keeping them sober. There was no program of what do I do now that the drinking has stopped. This same issue was confronted time after time after time with a host of other reformer clubs and social clubs that were all directed in the same vein. We briefly touched on the rise of the medical interest in alcoholism in the late 1800s, and I didn't even talk about this last week, but the medical cures that were hawked, that were sold, that were charlatanized, most of which had either alcohol or opium and morphine in them, which worked pretty well. Because I'm getting what I want. And I'm getting what I need. So, but again, what we didn't touch on was in the beginning of the 20th century, the rise of the psychological and the psychiatric professions and their attempt to deal with the likes of hopeless chronic alcoholics. Freud being Freud, if you have any familiarity with Freudian psychology, I'll sum it up in two words. Well, two phrases, really. Latent homosexuality and it's mommy's fault. it really is amazing when you Dumpty 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 Dumpty. Where did he talk about this? He proclaimed that every drinking bout is... we'll even begin before that. It was unresolved oral dependency in alcohol's replacement of women as a sexual object. Drinking was a sexual activity of the alcoholic. Every drinking bout is tinged with homosexuality, and men grasp at alcohol as a substitute for their vanishing procreative power. The view of alcoholism as a manifestation of latent homosexuality continued well into the second half of the 20th century. As an interesting note, this view was frequently applied to male alcoholics, but only rarely applied to female alcoholics. But more importantly, it was looked upon as not a primary disease, but only a manifestation of an underlying issue. And so that if the underlying issues were finally dealt with through long psychoanalytic process, then the alcoholism would disappear. The problem with that was drunks weren't too good at keeping appointments. They weren't really good at opening up. They also weren't really good at being consistent, and they also weren't too good about not drinking while they're going through all of this. Hence, the psychological community, the psychoanalytical community, wasn't too keen on accepting alcoholics as a patient. That's not that different from a significant portion of the medical community as a whole in the 20th century. For the most part, there was one quote from one doctor who, there were two classes of people that most hospitals did not want to accept, those with active venereal disease and alcoholism. Well, we're standing in good company here, you know. But for the most part, you know, we don't follow the rules. We're not cooperative. We didn't do what we were told, and the results were just, you know, were dramatically poor. We were shunted off to the edges of society. By this point, state psychiatric hospitals were pretty much the final home that most of us would finally be pushed off into. And we'll mention how Silkworth, when talking to Lois, Bill's wife, that, he talked about him having to be locked up in an asylum. So, 20s and also during this period of the early 20th century, what are we living with in this country? We're also living with Prohibition, one of the greatest drinking periods of our history. it was both illegal and classy to drink. And since it was illegal, there was large segments of the population that, you know, shunned anyone who did. And yet in the urban centers and whatnot, it was, you know, still thought of as, hey, we're just having a good time. And so a lot of alcoholic behavior was overlooked as, you know, through the roaring 20s and whatnot. I mentioned, you know, that question, what are we going to do with the drunk, really had no answer. None of the things that had been, you know, thrown at us or applied to us or imposed upon us had worked. There had, you know, the efforts by outsiders hadn't worked. The efforts of mutual aid societies such as the Washingtonians and whatnot, failing an ongoing program hadn't worked. Mutual aid was could only take it so far. There was the Keeley movement. Dr. Keeley, Illinois, I think, who claimed to have the absolute cure for alcoholism in the injection of the double chloride of gold treatment, of which he went to his grave never revealing the formula for it. Again, that was quasi-medical movement system that developed a huge following. They franchised treatment centers around the country, and several things were different in that movement. This was in the 1890s up into the early 20th century. They emphasized not just the you know, four times a day or something, the shot over a period of time, of which no one knew what was in it. But you had to be there for all four shots, and there were large numbers of people, and so there was an opportunity for a great deal of fellowship while you're standing around waiting in line. And they also began to hire reformed drinkers or recovered alcoholics or individuals who had gone through this treatment and were no longer drinking as personnel within the treatment facility. So here was one of the first instances where recovered alcoholics were introduced as valuable assets to those who were, you know, seeking to seeking help. And again, another element began to be added. And all of this history, these ideas that we've discussed last week and we'll talk about today, were all just little bits and pieces of what finally sprang to life in the late 1930s. At this time, concurrently with these treatments, there was another semi-religious organization that was sweeping the land called the Oxford Group, the Oxford Movement. It originally was known as the First Century Christian Fellowship. It was formed, it was created by Frank Buckman, a Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania. He traveled around the world and went to a conference of religious lectures in England, outside of Oxford. And many of his ideas that he received there, he formed into what would become the first century Christian Fellowship. One of which was to serve as in a missionary style. And he began to travel with a group of individuals that he banded together in England around the world. One of the first places that he went to was South Africa. And there was a group of them traveling by train, and the porter, knowing that they, you know, he was told that they were a bunch of you know, limeys from Oxford, wrote on the dusty windows of the train car, Oxford Group, in the dust. And they said, that's pretty cool. And they changed their name to the Oxford Group. Shorter, snazzier. You know, had pizzazz. And so, you know, I mean, so just the weird stuff that you can, that you find out that, you know, it's like First Century Christian Fellowship. Huh, it's kind of weighty. Oxford Group. Well, you know, and because it becomes, you know, more amorphous and you know, less directed and whatnot and less off-putting, and so it stuck. I say it's a quasi-religious group. They met in terms of what they would call house parties. They did not have. They termed themselves more of a determination than a denomination. Lutheran roots, Methodist influence as well. You know, so for the most part, a Protestant religious orientation. But their primary thought was that social change and world improvement could be accomplished through personal change and growth. If the individual can change and improve and can contact one other person and another over a period of time and over a period of history, then social change can be accomplished. They met in house parties, informally, in people's homes, so it became neighborly. They had four core beliefs. Everything that one of their primary techniques was to seek guidance from God, personal guidance from God, to have a personal relationship with God, and how to do that was to sit in guidance over a period of extended silence in and or throughout the day, most engaged in it in the morning. Whatever guidance they received was to be balanced against their four tenets: absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. Also, they had the five the five C's in terms of carrying this message or spreading this message: confidence, confession, conviction, conversion, and continuance. You know, first you needed to gain the confidence of the individual that you were speaking with. Confession. It was important to have a personal opening up of your own faults, your own failings, your own sins. And they spoke about it in terms of sins. and you needed to share your sins with another in within the group. They after the confession, then I never get the order right. Conviction, the conviction that God could and would help you improve if you continue to seek through continued guidance. Conversion, the giving up of one's own desires for self-aggrandizement and willing to convert, to the surrender of oneself to the power of God's will in your life, and then continuance to carry this message. So if you are at all familiar with our 12 steps, you can begin to again see the similarity of what would later become our 12 steps. They also had the five procedures. Give to God, listen to God's direction, check guidance with someone else, restitution of wrongs made, and sharing through witness. Again, the telling of one's story. Similar, so what does that have to do with Alcoholics Anonymous? This group, which was founded in the late 1920s, or mid-1920s, found its rise throughout the country in the 1930s and declined throughout the 1940s, where it actually changed its name to Moral Rearmament. Of the decline of the Oxford group occurred as a result of politics mixing in. Frank Buckman had some pro-Nazi leanings, and or at least some adherence to that, and so there was difficulty through the 40s with that, to say the least. But the Oxford group was alive and well in the 30s as a non-denominational, non-sectarian, semi-religious group of people trying to improve themselves and others within the small gatherings and within community. Let's jump the pond and go to Zurich, Switzerland. Yeah. 1931. Carl Jung is entertaining, or has a client, a patient, by the name of Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard, wealthy family, a business family, well-established business family from Rhode Island. His family would, for those of you who are familiar with some of the businesses, owned what would become, through name change, Allied Signal. And then Allied, and a very wealthy family. They had several other companies as well. He had means, and he was a drunk. The family sought out medical help, and everyone was pointing him to this well-respected psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Jung in Switzerland. And he goes there, and if you're familiar with the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, it mentions in there is a solution about Roland's treatment with Carl Jung. It says he went there for a year in 1931. Again, crazy research, can't be proven. Or, and then it's like, well, maybe he was there in 26. Maybe it was a year. Maybe it wasn't a year. Maybe it was several months. Maybe it was a couple weeks. Does it matter? No. It really doesn't matter because, as I said last week, the important part of all of this nonsense about getting the facts right of Alcoholics Anonymous and the history has little to do with me today as an active contributing member of a 12-step fellowship. How can I integrate the knowledge that I might have or can find useful so that I can show up and be useful to someone else? How does the history of a 12-step fellowship become my story? Where does it become real in my life? How can I better carry a message of hope and recovery by knowing what others did who have walked this before? How do I become just another link in the chain. 31, 26, 3 months, a year, doesn't matter. You can go down those rabbit holes, like I said, but just remember to come back up. Roland Sayer spends a significant amount of time in treatment. And he is filled with confidence that he has gotten it this time, that he no longer needs to drink. Gets back on the ship to head home, and by the time he gets to New York, he's drunk again. They send him back. And he goes back to Carl Jung in despair and says, I really thought I had it this time. I knew myself. I was aware of my shortcomings. I knew where my mind was failing me. I had all the ingredients, and yet I drank again. And a pivotal point in the history of 12-step fellowships is the humility of Carl Jung in realizing his lack, his inability to impose a cure, to impose upon this suffering alcoholic named Roland Hazard. The only thing he could do was give him the absolute truth. You're doomed. You're hopeless. Silkworth began to realize that it was only from that point of absolute deflation of self, the absolute deflation of ego, that there was no more hope of any kind. Was it possible for perhaps something to occur within the hapless, hopeless alcoholic that might move them to what he called a vital spiritual experience? Jung realized the limitations of the scientific or the pseudo-scientific medical ability to deal with the alcoholic. And he said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and I've never seen a single case recover with a state of mind that exists to the extent that it does in you. Is there no exception? Roland asked him. Yes. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena, something that he could observe but not explain. They appear in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of their lives are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conception and motives begin to dominate them. That he said, is what he'd been trying to achieve in Roland's mind, and it hadn't worked. He said, so the only thing that you can hope for is to experience a vital spiritual experience. Roland says, I'm a good guy. I'm a church member. You know, I contribute. I put money in the basket. I go regularly. He says, that's perhaps not necessarily enough. So Roland ends up, you know, going back. He's still separated from the substance. And what happens is he goes to the... gets home and is aware of the Oxford group. He's a man of wealth and privilege. He goes right to the source. He goes to the top. Sam Shoemaker, who was the Episcopal rector of the Calvary... church in Manhattan, and who was the pro forma leader of the Oxford group in the United States. And so, you know, he engaged in and joined in the Oxford group, working with Sam Shoemaker, and he got relief. He found that he no longer drank. Abstinence was not one of the tenets of the Oxford group. Improvement of oneself was. Improvement of one's other neighbors was, and improvement of society as a whole was their long-term goal. Abstinence, or recovery from alcoholism, was not a primary concern of those. Although many members of the Oxford group, seeing that alcohol and tobacco were causing them problems, would put it aside. And so Roland did that, accepted their the tenets, absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute love, began to practice these things, and remained sober. Around about this time, he also was, again, the interconnected weaving of individuals. There was a man by the name of Ebbie Thatcher, connected, a politically connected family from Albany, New York, and Ebbie was the drunk of the family. Ebbie, Roland Hazard, Seba Graves, Shep, God, I forget his last name. All at that point, their families for many, many years had been summering in Vermont. Well, Ebbie had been shipped off to Vermont because the family wanted to get rid of him. He was just, you know, an annoying drunk. He said, go paint the barn. He did. And when he was done, he went out on a bender, and he was, you know, because he was so proud of his work of painting the entire barn. And when he got back home, the pigeons had roosted back on the barn and did what pigeons do, and they had soiled his great paint job. To which Ebbie then got his shotgun and started blasting holes in the barn. To which the local constable took offense and arrested him for public drunkenness. I'm sure the schools would have been locked down if it were today. In any event, Ebbie's in the hooscow. And he's, you know, and he's about to be committed for alcoholic insanity, sent off to the asylum. Seba Graves, Roland Hazard hear of this, and they go and convince the judge, who was Gerald Graves, who happened to be the father of Seba Graves, he convinced them to release Ebbie into their guardianship. They took him back to New York and brought him to the Calvary Mission, and Ebbie began to, you know, sober up. At the Calvary Mission, there was in typical mission fashion, there was the testimony of what it was like and how and what things were like now. Ebbie sobered up, and there was a constant stream of individuals professing their, or bearing witness, you know, giving testimony of their recovery. And but again, one of the tenets of the Oxford group was conversion and service to others. Ebbie Thatcher, another boyhood friend from Vermont, was a man by the name of William Griffith Wilson, Bill Wilson, living on Clinton Street in Brooklyn at the point. He rings up Bill, and Bill is thrilled. Because, why is he thrilled? His old friend Ebbie is there. Lois is out working because Bill can't get a job. Lois is working in a department store, and she's going to be out most of the night. And Ebbie's going to come over and thinks this is just the greatest thing since sliced bread. We can relive our good old times, and I've got enough gin, you know, stashed around so that we'll be able to have a good time. That's what Bill's thinking. Ebbie's there for quite a different purpose, to see if Bill can be helped. He knocks goes up to the brownstone, knocks on the door. Bill opens the door. And there's something different about Ebbie. He's sober. Bill talks about, if you're familiar with Bill's story in the book, he says, there was something about his eyes. And he invites him in, and they go into the kitchen, and they sit across from each other at the table, and Bill pours himself a gin and pineapple juice, and he pours another one and pushes it across the table to Ebbie, and Ebbie says, no thanks, I'm not drinking. What do you mean you're not drinking? He says, you know, come on now. He says, I've got religion. And Bill famously writes, I was aghast. Last month, a little cracked up about alcoholism, and now he's cracked up about religion. But what Ebbie had done was accepted the tenets of the Oxford group, had found relief in the Oxford group, and was carrying that message of the tenets of the Oxford group to Bill, if he cared to have it. Bill was desperate. Bill had already been to Towns Hospital 3 times. Bill had already tried, as he talks about again in his story, trying to use his self-will, had tried to use his knowledge that he acquired. The famous story of Bill is on one of his last benders. This is late November. That last bender started on Armistice Day, Veterans Day, November 11th. He's going out to play golf in Staten Island. And he strikes up a conversation. He's taking a bus out to Staten Island, and the bus breaks down. And while they're repairing the bus, they go into a bar. And Bill begins to tell, he's had this conversation with this guy on the bus about, that he's not drinking, that he's been in rehab, Towns Hospital, for many, many years. Oh, and just by way of aside, I mentioned 3 times at Towns Hospital. What's Towns Hospital? So you're supposed to know. Towns Hospital, 293 Central Park West. An expensive drunk tank. It was a detoxification for people who could afford it. A week cost $125 back then. That was a lot of money. There were the asylums, and then by the 1930s, they were vanishing quickly, but Towns Hospital was one of the few hospitals devoted to the wealthy who were able to afford a place to dry out until their next run. What would be known as a rehab these days, there wasn't a great deal of hope that there would be only one visit and gone. It was just, we sobered them up enough to get them out the door for a while. Armistice Day, the bus breaks down. He's been to Towns Hospital. He begins to tell this companion that he's struck up a conversation with, that he can't drink, he's not going to drink, that he knows has all the reasons why he can't drink, and this, that, and the other thing. And the bus finally gets repaired. They get off to the golf course, but by then it's lunchtime, and they decide to have lunch before they go out on the links. And they go in, and Bill, without even Bill again is telling him he can't drink, and the bartender says, "Hey, it's Armistice Day. It's a round of drinks on the house." He puts a shot in front of Bill, and Bill picks it up, and the guy says, "You just told me all morning long that you're a hopeless chronic alcoholic, that you can't drink, and without even thinking, you just picked it up. You must be crazy." He says, "That's exactly what I am. I am absolutely insane when it comes to alcohol." And that began the bender. Late November, Ebby shows up on the door. He's got religion. He begins to offer his experience. This is the second time that someone who has recovered from alcoholism carries a message of hope and recovery. Roland carried it to Ebby. Ebby carries it to Bill. Bill's resistant. He knows he's doomed. He knows he can't do it on his own. He knows he can't do it with just medical attention. And yet he's resistant because the sense that this is religious. Bill had been resistant to any sort of religious influence because of his raising in Vermont, primarily as a result of his grandfather's his maternal grandfather who raised him. Refusal to accept strict organized religion, and he had passed that on to Bill. His inability to accept to be told how to pray and when to pray and what to believe in and who to believe in and how to organize and all of that. He felt that there was a power in the universe, but he'd be damned if he was going to believe that it was personal to him, and also that he needed to have any relationship to it in an organized fashion. Bill was resistant. And so that, and Ebby, again, is talking to Bill about his experience and how it worked for him. And Bill is drinking gin and pineapple juice. Ebby's drinking just pineapple juice. And the night goes on, and they continue to drink. And I don't know if you have ever had a conversation with a drunk who continues to drink, But the conversation oftentimes can get very, very circular. And if you expect to win that conversation, your chances are slim and none. Finally, this is told anecdotally, Bill's is just railing against, the belief of a God personal to him. And Emmy says, "Well, Bill, why don't you choose your own conception?" In Bill's story, he talks about how that melted the icicles that had kept him locked away. And yet, two things are important here. Bill was drunk at the time when he came to his second step consideration, that there was that he needed to believe in a power greater than himself. He was drunk when he made that second step concession, and he continued to drink. Very important. You don't need to be sober long at all. You don't need to be abstinent to move forward in this process. Powerlessness is an admission, a consideration that I need this power. I can do still lacking power. And the next thing that will happen is I need to make a decision. And I don't have to be sober or absent or any of those things in order to do that. I don't need a fellowship to know I'm broken. It's my illness. It's my malady. It is the substance that takes me to that place, or the affliction that takes me to the place where I can finally know it to my core. Bill continues to drink, and yet he is struck by the living example of God at work in this changed human being called Ebby Thatcher. What does Bill do? He's so impressed with this, he marches back down to, after a couple days, still drunk, to Calvary Mission, Calvary Church, and testifies. Drunk. And you finally get him off the stage, and Ebby begins to work with him a little bit more. And then December 11, 1934, Bill goes to the town's hospital as a patient for his fourth and last time. 3 days later, on December 14th, Ebby visits him again. And he, in effect, goes through what would later become our 12 steps. Bill is detoxed by that point, and he visits Bill in the hospital and has another talk with him. On page 13 in the basic text, you're probably familiar with this phrase, these paragraphs rather. This is Bill talking. "There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing. Without him I was lost." That would become our third step. Bill knew what his truth was when he showed up at Towns Hospital. He knew that because in his story he also admits that on page 8 when he says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity." Not in the booze, but in the self-pity. "Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." Again, he's drunk and he knows his truth and he continues to drink. Here, he makes his decision that from here on in, he's not running the show. His life, he's no longer managing his life. He gives it over to the care of God as he understood him. This new conception, no matter how vague or unsure he was of it. "I ruthlessly faced my sins, which would become our step 4, and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch." That would become our step 6 and 7. "My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies." That would become our step 5. "We made a list of people I had harmed or to whom I felt resentment." That would become 8. "I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability." That would become our steps 8 and 9. But what we're looking at here is about those 5 C's. Restitution, conviction, and all of that. It was when Ebby was giving him the Oxford Group program. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. That would become our step 10. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. That would become our 11, step 11. And later on, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead. That comes from the book of James. We'll get to that in a minute. In essence, Bill went through this process of what would become our 12 steps in Towns Hospital, 3 days separated from the substance. And he still resisted. Abby leaves. What he does is he leaves with him a copy of William James's thank you. Missing one word. I'm coming up with two varieties of spiritual experience. And so he, you know, he leaves it with him, and yet Bill is in his room, and he's tossing and turning and tossing and turning. He's reviewing everything that he and Abby have done. And ultimately, this last vestige of resistance, you know, he says that, in effect, he shouted out, "If there is a God, let him show himself to me." He then talks about the room filling with a spirit of energy, a white light, a wind, not so much of air, but of spirit. This lasts, he has no idea exactly how long, but he then calls Dr. Silkworth, who was his doctor at Towns Hospital, and asks him if he's crazy, or if what he has experienced is a spiritual experience. Sometimes it's as important what isn't said as what is said. Bill, for 3 days, had been undergoing hydrotherapy and the belladonna treatment. The belladonna treatment was a concoction of a variety of chemicals that were administered to the patient to detoxify them, and oftentimes it produced hallucinations. Bill, by his own account, later on said, "If Silky had told me that what I had was just a hallucination, I'd probably be dead by now." He said, "I don't know, but whatever you have, you had better hold on to it. It's better than you were before." And again, should you really trust the drunk? Should you really trust the new drunk? Everything, you know, all rosy and great. So I'll give you testimony of both the greatest supporter and greatest critic of Bill Wilson, Lois Wilson. It was evident to her. The wife, Lois, wrote, "The minute I saw him at the hospital, I knew something had happened. His eyes were filled with light. His whole being expressed joy and hope. From that moment on, I shared his confidence in the future. I never doubted that he was at last free." Our book talks about how oftentimes others around us see the change in us before we're ever able to see it in ourselves. Lois knew that man intimately and saw for the first time something different. It wasn't just the forsworn pledges and promises and hand on the Bible or anything like that. There was something different about the man. Something was different about Abby when Bill saw him. Now Lois shows up and says, "Wow, my husband is free at last. Now there's a change." He took seriously, and Bill again went to Calvary Mission as a regular participant, began to testify, wasn't drinking, wasn't working. Lois was still working, but he's very excited about this. And Bill, in all of his great humility, decided he's going to cure every alcoholic in the world. And he began to develop plans to do just that. And he begins running around trying to fix the drunks, cure the drunks, save the drunks. And they began to hold a whole bunch of meetings in Towns Hospital, in Clinton Street. They asked for the privilege to carry this message of what Bill had experienced in town's hospital, and with some reluctance it said, but Silkworth said, yeah, go ahead. So he began to get a steady supply of recently sobered up individuals from town hospital. They drag him over to Clinton Street. And what's going on, he's pulling guys from Calvary, and he's pulling guys from town's hospital and from anywhere that he can find them, and he's having absolutely no success whatsoever. They're all getting drunk again. But Bill isn't. The Oxford group wasn't too keen on Bill only wanting to work with drunks. They referred to him and Lois as being not maximum, meaning that they were applying themselves only in one specific direction, that they should be applying themselves to the greater good of the Oxford group as a whole. And Bill didn't listen to that. Well, there was actually the guys who were living at the Calvary Mission were actually barred from going to Clinton Street because they'd come back again with Bill's crazy ideas and cause trouble. Bill, for the first 6 months, has absolutely no ability to fix someone else. There was absolutely no other recoveries in New York City. Bill gets a job opportunity in a proxy fight for a company out in Akron, Ohio. Takes the train out there, and in basically 3 days, the whole deal goes south. The other members of the team that went out for this proxy fight, they realize it's hopeless and they go back home. Bill figures that maybe if he hangs around, there might just be the possibility that he can change the minds of some of the individuals. And so he stays on. It's the growing the weekend is coming. And it is the weekend, and Bill's down to his last couple of bucks. He doesn't have enough money to make it home, and he's getting thirsty. Things have gone bad. His grand plans haven't worked out. Nothing is going his way. He begins to feel sorry for himself. Oh, what's that I hear? Ah, the sound of merriment and joy coming from the bar in the hotel that he was staying at, the Mayflower Hotel. And it's calling to him. The sirens, he's hearing the siren's voice. And up until that point, he hadn't really thought about drinking. But he's feeling the urge, he's feeling the pull, he's feeling the need. And he figures that the only thing that can help him is if he begins to find another drunk to talk to. He goes over to the reader board, and there's a list of local churches with the pastors there. And with some of his last few coins in his pocket, he begins dialing these rectors or pastors or leaders of a variety of churches that are listed on the reader board, one of which was Walter Tunks, an Episcopal minister, and he says, listen, I'm a rum hound from New York and I need a drunk to talk to. Tunk says, I can't help you, but I think I know someone who can. And he gave him the phone number of Henrietta Seiberling, who was living on the Firestone estate. She was a daughter-in-law of Harvey Firestone, the tire company. And he calls up Henrietta Seiberling with the same line. My name's Bill Wilson, and I'm a rummy from New York, and I'm looking for a drunk to talk to. Henrietta later on said that she knew that this was the answer to her prayers. She was a member of the Oxford group in Akron. The Firestones were all very active in that, and one of the members of her house party, the group, was a man by the name of Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, who was sort of the project of the group. Ann Smith, her husband, Henrietta, and several others have been trying to sober up Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith for quite a while through the tenets of the Oxford group, and had no success whatsoever. She didn't know why this rummy from New York was calling up, but she said, I know just the person, you're just the person who can help, and I know someone who you can talk to. And I will make a phone call. She calls up Ann Smith, and this is on May 11th, 1935, and Ann replies after Henrietta explains the situation and says, you know, it would be wonderful for you to come over and if you could come over and talk to Bob, but tomorrow's Mother's Day and he brought me a potted plant and he's potted upstairs asleep, you know, and passed out. And but why don't you, we'll come over to your house tomorrow. So they made plans to meet at Henrietta Seiberling's place. Henrietta puts Bill Wilson up at her club in a room there, and Dr. Bob, hungover, shaky, not feeling well, agreed, give it 5, maybe 15 minutes to meet with this guy. He says, you know, after all, the least I can do is, you know, is maybe help this guy out. And so they show up. Dr. Bob is ready to give this guy 5, 15 minutes. And they retire to the den, and about 5 hours later they come out. And Dr. Bob would later say that this was the first man. Now, Bob is a medical doctor, a proctologist. And Bill, as is famously misunderstood, a failed stockbroker. He was never even a stockbroker. He worked around the markets, but he wasn't a stockbroker. But we'll leave it, you know, again, doesn't matter. Failed stockbroker. He said Bill was the first person who ever talked to him about his alcoholism, and he knew what he was talking about. Because Bill didn't talk at Dr. Bob, he just told his experience of what it was like for him. What he had done was talk about his personal experience and his downfall, but he also had had the benefit of all of those failures of the past 6 months in working with Towns Hospital patients and with the guys from the Calvary Mission. In the failure of that, Silkworth, the man who was the doctor, the primary doctor who worked over the course of his life with about 50,000 alcoholics, who had the ability to observe us and made some observations, was able for the first time in many years to come up with two tenets that were important to us. He observed that when we were separated from the substance, we behaved much like normal men. But when we ingested any amount of that substance, we reacted differently. He said that we had a sensitivity, an allergy to the substance that manifested in the phenomenon of craving. Again, a phenomenon, something I could observe but not explain. And as a result of this phenomenon of craving that condemned me to drink beyond my desire and ultimately to my death. And I couldn't not drink because I had a mind so compulsed with the relief, so obsessed with the idea that somehow, some way, I'd be able to successfully drink, or that somehow, some way, I'd be able to get the relief that I used to get. Bill had spent all of his 6 months in New York talking at the drunk about his need for what he called the hot flash. Yeah, go figure. You know, that wouldn't fly today. Maybe it would. I don't know. But you know, this what would later be called or mollified into the white light experience, his spiritual experience. And everyone thought Bill was crazy. Once he was cracked up about, you know, alcohol, now he's cracked up about religion. People were having the same reaction to Bill as Bill had to Bob, and Bill had to Abby. Silkworth said, first of all, you're talking at the drunk, Bill. You have to talk to him about the deflation. You have to take him down. You have to take him to that point of absolute hopelessness. You have to show them about the allergy of the body, their inability to drink safely, that once they put it in them, it triggers a reaction that demands more and more and more, and that desire is always intensified, never, ever, ever satisfied. You know, and you have to hammer the physical component home. And once you hammer the physical component home, you need to talk about that mind obsessed with relief, that mind obsessed with the idea that somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different. And once you get, you know, take them to the point of the allergy of the body, the physical reaction, and the mental obsession, then you can bring them to that point of hopelessness where they're willing to accept a spiritual answer. He carries this message for the first time to
to Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio. He tells him about his experience with his drinking, with his experience at Towns Hospital, with his experience about the allergy of the body. Now he's talking to a doctor. And Dr. Bob later said this was the first man who knew what he was talking about when it came to alcoholism. Bill had all three components: the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. Bob had been exposed to the spiritual through the Oxford group. He knew what the practical program of action was, but he didn't know of the allergy of the body and the malady of the mind, the obsession of the mind. That's what Bill brought to Dr. Bob. He got it. He stopped drinking. Several other things happened. The fellowship began to form that day. Ann Smith, most of the fellowship, began to be informed by those around us. Lois Wilson, Ann Smith. Ann Smith immediately said to Bill Wilson, "You need to come live with us." It wasn't, "Come over for lunch next Thursday." It wasn't, you know, "You should drop by sometime." It's like, "You need to come live with us." Bill didn't have any money. He needed a place to stay. He did. You know, all of this, these silly little coincidences that, and they began to realize that one drunk talking to another could influence another drunk as no one else had. Again, elements of the mutual aid societies, but here was medical information, the allergy of the body, psychiatric information, and a mind obsessed with relief, and a practical program of action, the attendance of the Oxford group. And all that spun together began to become our practical program of action. And they went to work. Dr. Bob had still had privileges, although barely, at a hospital in Akron. With his connections, they began to seek out others. Bill Dodson would become AA number 3, and that wasn't until about late June. But by late June, I skipped an important part. Bill is still living with Ann and Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob is still convinced that he's going to be fine, but he's also convinced that no one knows about his drinking. I also suffered such a delusion. I now know what a delusion that was. But so he was very resistant to this attitude, the tenet of the Oxford group that called for confession and restitution. It was okay that he was going to share his failings and faults with his wife and perhaps with Bill, but he certainly wasn't going to go parade around town and admit, you know, what he had been and all of that. And in the interim, Dr. Bob, still somewhat shaky but growing in confidence every day, says that it's important for him to go to the AMA convention. That year was to be held in Atlantic City, New Jersey. First time AA ever made it to New Jersey. He goes there sober, comes back drunk. And pretty much drunk for the entire time that he was at the convention. He was drunk before he got to the convention. He was drunk on the bar car on the way home. His nurse picks him up. They sober him up over the course of 3 days because Dr. Bob, the proctologist, with pretty shaky hands, has an operation to perform. They give him a barbiturate and a last beer, and he goes to perform the operation, and they sit home and wait. And there's no cell phones, and there's no texting, and there's no Instagram or any of that. They're just waiting by the phone, and no word comes back, and they don't know whether the operation has been a success or not. And then toward the end of the afternoon, Dr. Bob shows up. He's sober and he's content, because he has gone around town and admitted what he was and tried to set right, or at least give a plan of to set right all of the wrongs that he had done. He finally went through the rest of the program and made his 9-step amends. And he never drank again, bless you, until his death in 1950. It's on that day that we celebrate the birth of what we call Founders Day of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 12-step fellowship. Now, for those of you who want to go down the rabbit hole, they've done, as I mentioned briefly last week, they've done research, and based upon the dates of when the AMA convention was held in Atlantic City in 1935, Bob couldn't possibly have been home until June 17th. Does it matter? Maybe. Is it ever going to change? Founders Day? Nope. The dates, you know, are of little importance when you're dealing with the hope that we've been given as a result of this crazy odd coincidence of things that happened over the better part of several decades. A missionary traveling around the world with this idea of the Oxford Group. Knowledge gained from failed recovery groups in the 19th century. Influences from the psychiatric community. Influences primarily from Dr. Silkworth in the medical community. And mostly, wounded healers, sufferers, talking to each other, sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other, and figuring out, cobbling together some practical program of action that worked, and it surprised the heck out of them. They didn't really expect it to work. Nothing had ever happened, worked before. But because it worked for one, and then two, and then three, and then they began to try all sorts of crazy things, and we'll begin to talk about that next week. But by October of 1937, Bill and Bob were sitting around and they were counting up their success stories. They talked about substantial sobriety time. 2 years in for substantial sobriety time. And you know what? 2 years of separation and recovery is still substantial sobriety time, because sobriety isn't temporal. Abstinence isn't temporal. It's transformative. When spirit transforms the mind, it doesn't matter about the time, it matters about the transformation of mind by heart. But in 1937, in October, they counted up and they had about 40 recoveries, 40 cases that were recovered, both in Akron, New York, and at that point in Cleveland, Ohio as well. Now, there's more people in this room right now than were sober 2 years into the fellowship. We'll talk about next week how that was one of the blessings, that we grew so slowly that we had an opportunity to make our mistakes in a pretty empty environment and correct them as we went along. Other, you know, the Washingtonians and whatnot had rapid growth, and they rose and fell quickly because they didn't have the opportunity to make the mistakes in a small area. And so everything showed up in, you know, big time as a failure. Our slow growth became one of our greatest blessings for our solidity and our foundation. And I'll talk an awful lot about, you know, those the growth within the 40s and 50s and where it currently leaves us today. But just to give you a quick idea of some of the difficulties that they began to deal with in terms of once you began to travel around, or, you know, spread around the country, and the difficulties with organizations and you know, our flying blind period, as they talk about, is there was a group in West Virginia that thought the primary purpose of the AA group was to get away from the wives and to be able to drink beer during the meeting. There was a clubhouse out in in Minnesota that figured that if they were going to be self-supporting, the best way they could do it was to install slot machines in the clubhouse. Oh, go figure that we might come up with crazy ideas. So we will we'll see where, from that simple point of one alcoholic talking to another, we are able to meet here today, better part of 8 decades later, so that we can walk with a bit of dignity. Thank you so very much, and